Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Ben, no, we're not going back to WCPT. How's it going, everybody?
No, this taser in the rearview mirror. Can I just let the cat out of the bag, D? Come on. Sure. So, folks, just call me Maddie Millennial. We're doing this. I'm doing this on a laptop. Yeah. Okay. No, our listeners are out there like, big deal, Ben.
Yeah. Why are you bragging? Why are you, like, bragging about a laptop?
It took Dennis and me. He says 20 minutes. I say a half hour, whatever, about a half hour to figure out how to set this thing up. And then I realized it was all my fault because I didn't have the headphones plugged into the right place. Technical difficulties.
Guys, you should feel my pain as I coach Ben Jarofsky, the biggest boomer ever, on how to run a podcast. Now go to the initial settings. Volume settings. Yes. All right. Wait, now, is your volume up on your laptop? Whoa, how do I check that? Okay, send me a picture of your laptop, and I'll show you where the volume is on your laptop.
Oh, God, it was so funny. It was painful when I was going through it. And, you know, by the way, shoe on other foot. Many of the time I'm watching Dennis or DJ Nate, the weekend producer, coaching a boomer through a similar thing, and I'm sitting there so high and mighty going, oh, God, boomers. Can't you get used to this technology? Yeah. There I was.
Little do they know, you don't know where the volume is on your laptop.
Then it's like, there's three dots. You see the three? I don't see any three dots. No, there's three dots. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, you know there's three dots on a laptop? Yeah. Didn't know that. Huh? Yeah.
I don't know if that's really true. Hey, Sergio's listening. What's going on, Sergio?
Oh, my God. Last week, Sergio was on with Monroe, and that was hilarious. I urge, if you haven't listened to it, Sergio Mims and Monroe Anderson, very, very fun. We got to bring them back together, D, because they're very good together as a combo, in my humble opinion.
All right. Your Ben Jarofsky Show for Wednesday, September 22nd is just moments away. But before we do this, let's thank our sponsors. Sponsors like SEIU Healthcare, Illinois, Indiana. The Chicago Federation of Labor are sponsors. Chicago Teachers Union are sponsors, and Chicago Reader. ChicagoReader.com for all things there is to know the city of Chicago, where to go, what to do, what to eat, what to drink, what kind of pot to smoke, and so much more, including columns from our very own Ben Jarofsky. Chicago Reader, ChicagoReader.com. Subscribe, and you can help out this program if you'd like. ChicagoReader.com/Jarofsky, J-O-R-A-V as in victory, S-K-Y, and you can become a bin head. Ben, hit the shot. Oh, never. Not the greatest jumper. Here, give me the ball. Ah, yeah, that's how you do it. The Ben Jarofsky Show starts now. It is Wednesday, September 22nd, and live from my apartment and his attic, this is the Ben Jarofsky Show. Today on the program, Monroe Anderson returns. I repeat, legendary Chicago journalist Monroe Anderson returns. And Miles Camp Lassen. And now your host, Brick Shot Benny? Chicago Reader columnist Ben Jarofsky.
Hello, everybody. Ben Jarofsky here. We're calling this Rom Gets Rich Wednesday, and here's why. Because Rom got rich. That's why. All right. Let me set the scene. It was Monday morning. I was dutifully writing my column, a brilliant dissertation on the budget process when all of a sudden, pew, that's the sound of a text coming in. I got a text from a man in Chicago that I will identify only. Oh, let's give him a nickname, Deep Throat, because he probably doesn't want to be identified. All he was doing was sending me a tweet that had just come out from a gentleman named Kenneth Vogel, New York Times reporter. I'm going to give a shout out to Kenneth Vogel, enterprising New York Times reporter. Apparently, he had just been waiting for the moment when public documents showing what Mayor Rahm, his financial disclosure statements, he was required to disclose his income over the last few years because he wants to be ambassador to Japan. That's how much Mayor Rahm wants to be ambassador to Japan. He released all his financial documents or his financial statements revealing how much money he's made over the last few years. This reporter from the New York Times, Kenneth Vogel, jumped on it and he immediately sent it out in a tweet. And Deep Throat here in Chicago saw it and sent it to me. And so all of a sudden, you had to hear this sound. Whoosh! That's the sound of me ripping up one column, metaphorically speaking, because it was just on a computer. And tick, 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 tick. That's the sound of me typing another column. Yes, the glamorous life of a Chicago reader-writer, folks. It's not what you think it is. Meanwhile, I'm doing all this, by the way. I just want to point out, I'm wearing my pajamas. Like, just like Hugh Hefner, because it's, you know, hadn't quite got dressed yet. By the way, Monroe Anderson has joined us. He's on deck. He'll be coming on real soon. Anyway. Monroe will enjoy hearing this. It turns out that while Mayor Lori Lightfoot was giving her budget address to the Chicago City Council roughly the same time, I was reading how much money Mayor Rahm had made. And so Mayor Lori Lightfoot is pledging to do everything she can, moving heaven and earth to help the poor, eradicate the plight of the poor. Meanwhile, Rahm's getting rich. And that's how it goes in the city of Chicago, ladies and gentlemen. Mayors say they're going to help the poor, but the poor somehow or other never get help by the city of Chicago. And meanwhile, mayors go on and make a lot of money. Now, Mayor Rahm made over $13 million. I wrote a column about it. You can read it in the New York Times. The Chicago Sun-Times, Lynn Sweet wrote about it. And today you can read her version of the same story if you want. Or you could just go back to Kenneth Vogel in the New York Times and read the actual financial documents that Mayor Rahm had to submit. You could read all three of them. But the bottom line is this. Mayor Rahm made over $13 million. A good chunk of it, $12 million, as an investment banker. I remember when I had to interview Rahm many, many years ago. This is when he was running for Congress back in 2002 in the 5th Congressional District. And he had just made a big chunk of cash as an investment banker. And so I asked him, I go, so to become an investment banker, did you have to start out as a teller and kind of work your way up? He snickered at me and kind of gave me that look like, this guy is an asshole. I don't want anything to do with him. And the reality is this, folks, being an investment banker has nothing to do with the fundamentals of banking. You don't have to know anything about being a teller. You don't even have to make change from a dollar bill. All you need to have is a Rolodex or a cell phone filled with contacts, people that are very important and influential in government, so that you could call banker B and hook him up with Congressman X or someone at the Treasury Department or someone in the White House or whoever you need to make the deal go. That's how it works. What you need to be an investment bank. You don't have to know anything about being a teller. Anyway, Rahm has made a fortune, $13 million, including part of that money was like over $300,000 he got from ABC TV. This is a joke. Monroe is going to love this. Mayor Rahm got $300,000 plus to be a guest on the George Stephanopoulos show. That's $300,000 plus more than Monroe has gotten for being a guest on the Ben Jarofsky show. So clearly Rahm has got either a better agent than Monroe has, or George Stephanopoulos and ABC have more money than I have. What a joke. Hey, folks, if you've ever heard Rahm, what passes for great thoughts and observations by Rahm on the George Stephanopoulos show, you can just say to ABC, man, you wasted your money. Although I would make the argument that Rahm is perhaps more cogent and believable than Chris Christie, who's often his guest on the George Stephanopoulos, sidekick on the George Stephanopoulos show. Anyway, I urge everybody to check out that story, to read about how Rahm just did really well for himself once he left office. $13 million plus dollars he made. And the way I figured it out is, think about it this way. If Rahm were a TIF district, just think about Rahm as a TIF district, okay? He accumulated more money over the last couple of years than Englewood TIF district. How about that? So instead of helping the poor, we help the rich. We got a great show today, everybody. Monroe Anderson, he's not rich, but he's rich with insights. I'm looking at him right now. And then Miles Konflassen in the second half of the show from In These Times. And will be joining us, talk about all the issues of the day. So, Monroe, welcome back. Welcome back to our humble airwaves.
Okay, good to be here. You know, talking about Rahm and the money and et cetera, I am reminded of Reverend Ike. Do you remember Reverend Ike?
Yes, Reverend Ike. I used to listen to
Reverend Ike had this great quote. He said, "The best thing I can do for the poor is not be one of them."
I agree, Reverend Ike. Oh, man, Reverend Ike's radio show. What a piece of work. That was back in the, I want to say in the 60s and the 70s, it would come on at Sunday nights. And, you know, I was a radio junkie, Monroe. I don't know about you, but I used to have that transistor. I'd listen to everything. And so
I was listening to music, not to talk.
Well, you know, I mean, I listen to a lot of music, too. But at Sunday nights, there wasn't, you know, in the back in those, the old days, Monroe, yeah. They would go to public service shows a lot, you know, and I can't remember where her Reverend Ike is. And now I'm blanking on his real name. His real name is not Ike. It's something else. Anyway, so, yeah, Rahm took a page from the Reverend Ike playbook. We'll probably be talking a little more about Rahm in the second part of the show when Monroe joins us. Steve Mnuchin is also in the news. He, oh, my goodness, former Treasury Secretary under Donald Trump. He's already put together, I think, an investment banking fund of over $2.5 billion with a B dollars. That's how much he's raised. The rich get richer, and Ben and Monroe get to talk on a podcast. How about that? All right, Monroe, let's start with the very sobering pictures, the upsetting pictures, to put it mildly, coming from the border of security officers on horses whipping Haitians. I'm like, was this like a scene from 12 Years a Slave? Was this like out of Django? I mean,
The thing is, they were crackers. I think I've mentioned this on your show before, but my theory as to how racist white people got the moniker crackers was that it comes from plantation times when the overseers cracked the whips on the slaves to make them work harder or to punish them for not working hard enough or just because they felt like beating a black person that day. For whatever reasons, they would crack the whip. And so that's how they got the nickname. And this is what these guys were doing. Yeah, they didn't have whips. They were using the leather that you use to control a horse. I forget the term for it, but
the reins.
They were using
the reins.
Yeah, the reins. These reins were very long, and so they were using the reins, and chasing down the Haitians and whipping them. With it to make them get back in wherever they wanted them to be. And, you know, the thing is, can you imagine if these were some white people from Canada on the northern border trying to slip into the United States, if they'd be treated quite that way?
Yeah, no.
No, it wouldn't be.
So let's talk about it. There's two ways to talk about this. One, just raw racial terms, which we'll get into, and then political terms.
Yeah. And let's also talk about humane terms while we're at it. As in, these people, they suffered a hurricane, an earthquake, an assassination of their president. The country is in total chaos. Thousands of homes were destroyed. So it's not like you can just go back home. And we're gathering them up and dropping them off back on the island.
Really twisted, man. The whole history of the United States with Haiti, I could give a whole dissertation on it, hold back on that. But it's been
Well, with white people at Haiti in general, because they were the first slave colony to get freedom. And what's really amazing about that is that after they had their revolution and freed themselves from the French colonists, then France made them pay back money for freeing themselves. You know, it's sort of like Elder and him saying that the plantation owners ought to get reparations because they lost property.
Oh, my goodness, Governor Elder. Larry Elder, yes. Let's just pause. I'll never forget watching that clip of him on the Candace Owens show, Larry Elder, and explaining. And because she was like, well, I don't get where you're going at with this. And so he explains it to her about how, well, you know, if you view slaves as property, when you freed them, you're taking away the property that the slave owners own. So you got to compensate them for the property. And the part that, I mean, that's whacked out enough, Monroe, but the part that gets me every time is Candace Owens nodding her head like, oh, yeah, I never thought of it that way.
Well, actually, I never thought of it that way either.
But she was impressed.
When I heard it, I said, that's crazy.
Monroe, I'm going to ask a question that's so obvious, but I'm going to ask it anyway. I mean, it's not really a question. It's just the hatred of black skin is so deep.
Right.
I mean, I've watched the reactions over the years that white people have when black people come in their neighborhood as opposed to any other color. And it's really deep. It's just like in your head, you know, you can't escape it. It's just part of your psyche. It's what you're taught from the earliest moment. And so I just the different reactions, like when Cubans come to this country, the different attitudes about immigration, when Afghanistan refugees come to this country, Vietnamese refugees come in, and I'm not hating on any of these refugees. Okay. I'm not hating. I'm just saying the different attitude with something about when the skin is dark, people lose their minds.
Yeah. You know, Richard Pryor had this joke about the Vietnamese. He said, when they brought him over here, the first thing they told was, nigger, 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 with an Asian accent, you know.
First word they learned.
Right.
You know, it's always trouble, by the way, a tangent with a tangent. Oh, whenever a guest starts, it's always a boomer, starts to quote a Richard Pryor joke, I'm like, uh-oh, where's he going? Because, man, I love Richard Pryor to death. Monroe knows that because that's our generation. But a lot of his humor just does not translate into these politically correct times, Monroe. I'm just telling you that.
Oh, yeah. No, I had a woman who had listened to him, a boomer, had listened to him, but hadn't listened to him in a long time. And she says to me, I didn't realize his humor was so misogynistic.
And yet some of it is so true and so relevant even today. It just blows my mind. His two stand-ups that are, you could see, they're probably playing on YouTube. They're just so brilliant. Anyway, all right, enough on Richard Pryor. But all right, that's the racial terms. It's just, our country's attitude toward Haitians is so baffling because Haitians have lived in the United States for so long.
Well,
contributed to the United States for so long.
Jean-Paul Baptiste DuSabo.
Yes.
Baptiste DuSabo was a Haitian.
Yeah. That's true.
The founder of our city.
Yes. Wow. They'd be whipping him if he right. across the border too.
Right, exactly.
So, all right. I got to give a shout out to April Ryan. I was telling you about this. She is with Griot, and I forget which network she used to be on. She made a name for herself as a very determined questioner of presidents at press conferences. Did not back down. Had a lot of guts, and Trump hated her. And she has, I think she was on ABC. I don't remember Monroe anyway.
Yeah, no, she asked him hard questions.
She would ask him hard questions. Yeah. And he just hated her.
And since he's a racist, a white supremacist racist anyway, the idea that a black woman, and a misogynist too, so the idea of a black woman asking him these questions just really got under his skin.
Absolutely. Well, she was coming at Jen Psaki, who is Joe Biden's press secretary. She was coming at her strong yesterday. And I don't know if you saw those clips, but
Jen now, Psaki. Sometimes I watch those press conferences, but I didn't. Oh, yeah, I was being interviewed for another Harold Washington documentary.
Another one?
Yeah. So,
which one was this?
It's okay. We're way off track.
Yeah. Well, let's get back to the
Okay, we can pick up, I'm in Punch 9, the documentary. That's been finished. It's been in the making. I was a young man when I was first interviewed. And it was so long ago. But anyway, I'm in that, and it's had a screening at the International Film Festival, or it's going to happen.
Yeah, no, we talked about that with Sergio last week. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So this one is being done by a guy named Craig Williams, who is from Chicago, but he's a producer. He's out in L.A. now. And he's doing one about Harold, and he has old footage. In fact, he was telling me that somebody was doing a black series, biography series for BET, and interviewed Harold, Eartha Kitt, just a bunch. I mean, it's a whole bunch of famous black people who were interviewed. He went through the names. I was being interviewed. I wasn't taking notes, so I'm doing this off of memory. And one of them was Harold. And so he's doing the Harold, but he also Jesse's another one that was in it. But anyway, he's going to do all these biographies with interviews from the actual people who are now dead, and people who are living who can talk about them or who knew them. For example, with Eartha Kitt, he's going to interview a couple of the women. Eartha played the Catwoman. So he's going to interview a couple of the current black women who've played Catwoman.
All right. Wait, I don't want to go down that because that could be a whole other tangent. I want to get back to the political ramifications. So I did watch at least one segment, the exchange with April Ryan, basically cross-examining, coming at her hard, and deservedly so, and I applaud her for it, because what Jen Psaki did was what press secretaries generally do. Monroe knows this game because he was a press secretary.
Yeah, right.
So there's a hard, tough question about what went down on the border where these border patrolmen are cracking the whip, literally, on Haitians trying to get into this country. And clearly, the Biden administration has not figured out what possible response could give, which straddles the line between being tough, quote unquote, on people trying to sneak into the country and being not being racist. Okay, they had to figure it out.
And they're also trying to be humane, since Trump was not. You know, they're the anti-Trump administration, or trying to be.
Yeah. So what Psaki is saying? Well, I don't know the context of it. And then she, in the same breath that she says, "I don't know the context of it," she says, "And I don't know what possible context there could be to justify it." So, in other words, she doesn't want to criticize what she saw, without being able to say, you know, she doesn't want to criticize it because that would look like she's criticizing the policy itself. And they want to make sure, like, they look like they know what they're doing at the border, Monroe, and that there's a purpose to what they're doing. At the same time, they don't want to dismiss they because that would be inhumane, as you pointed out. So she's really trying to walk this fine line, and April Ryan is not having it, Monroe. She's right. gonna keep coming at her.
Right. Like,
what? Who's responsible for this?
Right. Right.
So politically, how do what's the fallout politically?
Well, the fallout politically, it's with the MAGA people. They see this 15,000 or so Haitians at the border as barbarians at the gate, and Trump kept them out, you know, and Biden's too weak and too soft and too incompetent and too senile to keep them out. And that's how they're playing it. And that, you know, they're white power and proud of it.
Yeah, that's how they're playing it, meaning that's how MAGA's playing it.
The MAGA people are playing it, yes. Yeah. And Biden is trying to be a little more civil about it. But the thing is, I mean, if he had the power, which he doesn't, that's his problem with that 50-50 Senate split and a bunch of several blue dog Democrats at that, he can't push it as far as he may want to, because the thing would be to just let them in, you know, just let them into the country. And they are letting a lot. If you have family here, if you're Haitian and you have family here and you're family, they're letting you stay. They're sending the plane loads they have sent so far. It's been single adult Haitians. So for those poor people, you know, you don't have any family. You don't have any loved ones. We put you back out there. You got to fend for yourself.
Well, apparently nobody told the Border Patrol that it was a new administration that was humane and sensitive to the needs
of
refugees. Nobody told them that. They didn't get that message. They somehow or other, that message wasn't communicated.
Right. No, they're stuck back in 2018. So.
Yeah, it's 2018 as far as it's permanently 2018, and Trump's in charge. I don't know if Joe Biden will ever figure out a strategy or approach for immigration, Monroe, coming from the southern border. It's such a politically, as you were pointing out, it's such a politically charged issue. MAGA is vehemently against any form
and the Republican governors are beating it, you know, that horse.
Yes.
Abbott is just indignant that he would let these people do this, and he wants an investigation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
It's a different kind of to the point. It's a different investigation. So April Ryan wants an investigation as to what led Border Patrolmen to think they could just whip Haitians.
Right.
And Abbott wants an investigation into how did those Haitians get to that point and why weren't they whipped beforehand?
And why didn't they shoot some of them? Why did they try to save on bullets or something? I'm joking, of course. Yeah. That's the mentality.
That's where we are right now.
Right.
That's our country right now. And a guy like Biden is concerned and afraid that you're right, Monroe, politically speaking, if he goes too far to appease the April Ryans of the world, then he'll be exposed on his right flank, if you will. And the Greg Abbotts of the world will come at him strong. So, you know, an old fashioned centrist Democrat, man, that's a tough position. That's a lot of spinning that he's going to have to do.
Yeah, it is a lot of spinning. And I think what we should do is give the French their Statue of Liberty back. That's, you know, just say, you know, because it was a gift because we, not we, they freed the slaves. They freed my ancestors here in America. And as a result of the freeing of the slaves, the French gave us, the U.S., or them, however I want to look at it. But anyway, they gave them the statue. And then you have the poem that I forget the woman's name. They poet.
Lazarus.
Yeah. You know, give us your poor. Anyway, all that is null and void. Now, that's so 19th century.
You know? No, it is. I remember old boy. What was his name? Miller. Stephen Miller. The aide to Trump who concocted this whacked out notion about keeping immigrants out, even though he is a descendant of immigrants.
Right.
He's getting into it with a White House reporter about that poem. And he was trying to say that the poem really didn't mean he was trying to reinterpret. I got to give him credit, man. He did it with a straight face. It's like, well, you know, the poem is, it's not really about letting people in. You got to understand there was another. Then he started quoting some other part of the poem that keep the people out. I just made that up, but I'm like, God damn, what a twisted mind at play right. here.
Right. And you know, his family has disowned him.
Well, speaking of families disowning you, perfect transition. Okay. Donald John Trump, former president of the United States, has sued his niece, Mary Trump, and the New York Times. And this story just broke today. I saw it
it broke yesterday.
Okay, well, me it broke today.
Yeah.
I'm a little behind. This is a twisted, warped world. You know, he claims that she violated terms of the family agreement when she released confidential financial information about his taxes to the New York Times.
Yeah. And that she conspired with the New York Times to do this so they could sell newspapers and get awards, I guess, and just hurt his feelings.
Yeah, I think it's the world's dumbest lawsuit because as we've had this conversation before with Jim Coogan, it exposes Trump to depositions. So now, all right, he's suing her. Yeah,
they're right.
And, you know, all right, well, let's get our lawyers in. And this got Bill Clinton in trouble. I'm utterly obsessed with the show impeachment. It got Bill Clinton in trouble in those depositions.
Right.
So my guess is, Monroe, and I'll get your thoughts on this. My guess is Trump will have dropped this lawsuit long before they get to the deposition stage where he's going to be forced to, answer questions under oath. What's your thoughts about this lawsuit?
He will. I mean, he is the biggest sewer litigator in the most litigious person in America. I mean, he has thousands of suits over his lifetime. He'll sue at the drop of the hat. Lawrence O'Donnell on MSNBC brags about how Trump threatened to sue him and never got around to it. He sues over anything and everything. So, and he makes up the numbers, you know, $100 million. Mary couldn't pay him that if she lost the suit, and no judge would give him $100 million. Now, because there was a non-disclosure, conceivably, he could win the case, the suit, because, you know, she's legally bound not to give up the information, which she did. But as you've pointed out, he's going to have to go into the courtroom and go under oath. And so he's not going to want to do that.
Yeah. And my memory is that that was already litigated and she prevailed on the issue of the non-disclosure agreement where a judge ruled, and I'm doing this from memory, that the the world had changed dramatically from whenever that she agreed to that non-disclosure agreement. One of the big changes is that her uncle is now president of the United States, and there's a very relevant, pressing public interest in seeing the documents that she was providing.
Yeah, but that was then. He's no longer president.
Yeah, but he's suing in regards to what went down in 2018, when he was president.
Right.
So what I'm saying is that she had already prevailed on that issue, which, you know, back like a couple of years ago. So I don't know where the lawsuit's going, but my guess is that. But it just goes to show you Donald Trump is still playing his old games. It's interesting. His lawyer that in the old days his attack dog was Michael Cohen. Who would be the lawyer that would file the suit or call somebody to threaten the lawsuit.
Right.
You're right. That's the game Trump played. Yeah, I'm going to bring in my lawyer. And now Cohen, of course, has turned against Trump. Trump turned against him. And so he can't go to Cohen anymore. And meanwhile, Trump's the
fourth. And Giuliani is preoccupied.
Yes, Giuliani. Oh, my God. There was a. Did you see Giuliani? Where did I see this? I saw this on Twitter or something. I can't believe I saw this on Twitter. When I was going through reading about Rahm's financial disclosure, Giuliani is doing ads for MyPillow now. I mean, it's just it's so bizarre out there in Trump world.
Oh, I know. I know. Because Mike Lindell is there are certain he's been ostracized for because he continues to tell the big lie. So he's been ostracized in certain places. They aren't even accepting his advertisements anymore for MyPillow.
He's still in the heart of Rudy Giuliani. Miles Konflassen has joined us. Miles Konflassen from In These Times. And Miles, we're just going to bring you right in. There's no need with our – we have cut a new deal with Google. I'm not quite sure how it works, but for some reason we don't have to take a break. So, Miles, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Very glad to be here. It looks like your new setup is working great over there. I can hear you loud and clear, Ben.
Yeah, some miraculously. I was telling Miles before the show, get this laptop and let's hope it works. And it is working thanks to Dennis. He did all the hard work. All right, Miles, we've been talking about Donald Trump suing his niece, Mary Trump. Let's move things up a little bit. We probably will get into Trump and financial disclosures when we talk about Rahm. But let's start with the reconciliation bill, or the attempt by Bernie Sanders. This is a favorite topic of conversation when you come on this show, to try to force the Democrats into doing the right Democratic Big D thing when it comes to helping people in this country and redistributing income in such a way that it's not so unfair. What's the latest in your assessment coming out of Washington right now? Will Bernie prevail with Biden? Or will Sinema and Manchin, the Dems, who very bizarrely seem to ally with Republicans on these matters, undercut Bernie Sanders? Take it away, Miles.
Well, what a strange situation, right? That we have Bernie Sanders here. Who would have thought a year ago, you know, in the midst of the Democratic primary, that we would have Bernie Sanders being the champion of Joe Biden's economic agenda, his Build Back Better agenda. And he is the one who's trying to, you know, coerce his colleagues and whip votes behind the agenda that Joe Biden supports and has been pushing against the opposition by so-called moderate, I call them right-wing Democrats, who are trying to derail the entire agenda and apparently, you know, stop it in its tracks by refusing to support the reconciliation package. The reason this is important now is next week is there's some really important deadlines coming up. The first one is kind of an artificial deadline, but it's one that Democrats agreed to. This on Monday, the 27th, is when Nancy Pelosi agreed to schedule a vote for the bipartisan infrastructure bill. This, you know, kind of $500 trillion investment in physical infrastructure that a lot of these right-wing Democrats really pushed and negotiated with Republicans. And they did get 19 Republicans in the Senate to support it. The House hasn't voted on it yet, so we don't know if any Republicans are going to support it there. But Monday was the deal that they made to get this passed in the Senate so that the Senate could go on recess. And the deal that was made was effectively, okay, we'll support reconciliation along with infrastructure, but we want infrastructure done by the 27th. And it seems kind of a game of chicken because they're essentially saying, okay, let's see if you can win us over on this broader social investment package by then. And that package includes everything from expanding health care and child care to paid family leave and investments in climate mitigation. A lot of basically Joe Biden's entire domestic agenda is packaged into this bill. And Nancy Pelosi has got her work cut out for her to figure out a way to get figure out how to handle this situation where there's going to be a showdown on Monday. Now, she says still the reconciliation bill is going to be done by Monday, that it'll be written and that they'll be ready. So she's still standing by that. But she's also standing by her strategy of saying we're not going to vote on the bipartisan bill until we have agreement on the reconciliation package. So, yeah, we'll see. We'll see what happens. But go ahead, Mitt.
Yeah. One thing she can do, and this is to pass the bill and then not give it to the president. She does. There's no law that says once a bill is passed, she has to give it to him to sign. And so she can pass the bill to satisfy the less progressive Democrats, and then just sit on the bill until the reconciliation bill gets ready, and then she can send it both to them at the same time.
Yeah, I think there's a few different legislative, you know, mechanics that she could do and that the Senate could do. She could also just delay the vote. I mean, what I'm sure that they don't want to see happen is, what the so-called centrist Democrats don't want is to see the bill fail. And, you know, right now it doesn't have the support. Pramila Jayapal, the head of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, representative from Washington, says that half of her caucus, which is over 90 members, is prepared to vote against the bipartisan deal in the House. So that if Nancy Pelosi even brings it up on Monday, even if she's not going to send it to the president, unless there's a deal on this reconciliation package, they're not going to support it. And I don't think she's going to bring the bill up for a vote if it's not going to pass. I mean, Nancy Pelosi doesn't do that. So, so that's really where the challenge is. And today at the White House, President Biden is meeting with a whole host of players in this. The collection of these centrist Democrats are coming, Manchin and Sinema included, as well as Bernie Sanders and Pramila Jayapal. So he's trying to, you know, get them all together and find a way to pass his agenda. And his biggest ally he has is Bernie Sanders, who Everybody thought, you know, was going to be his opponent throughout this stuff. But in fact, He's the one that's carrying on the Biden agenda and trying to push it forward. And as I said, trying to convince these recalcitrant members to get on board and support their Democratic president.
Well, in your sense, who is going to make the most significant compromise, Miles? The moderates or Bernie?
Well, assuming that a deal is made that they can get anything through, I mean, you would have to guess that there's going to have to be some more negotiation. But I think that's still up in the air. I mean, Sinema and Manchin have not said that they'll support anything. You know, they haven't put forward any kind of counter proposal. They just said, we want a strategic pause on this bill. We want to pass the infrastructure. They want to go back to their constituents and, you know, campaign on that and just forget about the whole, you know, human infrastructure agenda. So I would have to guess that there would be some negotiation around it. And most likely, I think you'd see what you saw in the original negotiation. You know, Bernie Sanders and the rest of the Democrats that authored the original reconciliation package originally wanted it to be $6 trillion, and they lowered it to 3.5 at the demands of the, you know, centrists in the Senate, including Manchin and Sinema. So what they would say is that they've already massively compromised. Yeah. And the way that they did that is by basically lowering the lifetimes of these programs so that they would, you know, programs that were meant to go on for 10 years or go till 5 years. For example, the child tax credit, this landmark legislation that's sending, you know, $300 per month to American families for each child, an incredible social investment that they originally wanted to extend permanently. And there's a lot of pressure to do that. But the current House bill, which was made in, you know, collaboration with the Senate, only extends it till 2025. So I think what you'd see is more negotiation around those things about the lifetimes of these programs. There's a whole questions of a means testing, which Joe Manchin is pushing, basically saying we want to lower the eligibility and make it harder for people to access the benefits. That's going to be a fight as well, I'm sure, that will come up. But yeah, I think that this week is going to be really important in figuring that out. Also on Thursday, we should say Thursday is the deadline to do something with the debt limit so that the U.S. doesn't default. And Republicans have said they're not going to help the Democrats at all. They're willing to just let the economy default, which would wipe out nearly 6 million jobs. It would lift the unemployment rate to 9%.
They're bluffing. They're not going to do that. They're masters. Well, the masters of the universe. Not going to let the stock market take that hit, even temporarily. So Mitch is bluffing on that one, I think.
Well, what do you think will result then? Do you think that they'll sign on board and not stop filibustering it?
Right. Well, they may filibuster it a little while, but ultimately they because that's money that's already been spent. No, it's not like. Okay, well, this is my Christmas shopping list, and I want all these things. And the Republicans are saying, no, you only can have 10% of it, not all of them. The gifts have been unwrapped. They're in the house. And so they have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm. Or I agree with you, but the House has already passed that bill that would extend the government funding, and that the Republicans in the Senate have filibustered it. So it is currently, you know, stalled. So unless
Mitch McConnell, when we get to the deadline,
I wonder what is the end game for Mitch McConnell on this. So other than bringing back. They're so bizarre, man. How anybody believes anything a Republican says. They're bringing back their concern, alleged concern, for fiscal responsibility.
Right.
And living within our means. Right. If you recall, they had abandoned that during the Trump years.
Right.
After when it didn't matter, when we gave the massive cut in taxes on the wealthy. So now they're going back to that, rhetorically speaking, Miles. And they're trying to redress themselves as fiscal conservatives who care about things like balanced budgets, which is utterly absurd. So I don't know ultimately what he wants. Do you understand, Miles?
Well, I think that what he wants is pretty clear. It's what he said at the outset of Joe Biden's presidency, that he wants to block his entire agenda from going through and make sure Joe Biden's a failed president. And one way to do that is by making sure the economy craters. So I would like to think that he has more of a sense of that. But I think McConnell is a purely political, power hungry figure. And if he sees an opportunity to, you know, to make Biden's life as hellish as possible and increase his political prospects, even if it means tanking the economy, he's willing to do that. The other thing that could happen, of course, is Democrats could just, you know, push it into the reconciliation bill. The problem with that is they would have to then send it back to the Senate and back to the House. There would have to be this whole other voterama, and that screws with the whole timeline on getting reconciliation passed, which they've also put a deadline on for if it's linked to the infrastructure bill. So, yeah, I think it's going to be a real test of what the prowess of the Democratic Party and whether they can hold together to pass an agenda that actually would help working people. You know, I mean, this would be completely historic legislation if they can find a way to get it passed. But the people standing in the way of it right now, as you mentioned, Joe Manchin, I mean, he's the highest paid member of the Senate from, you know, donations from the gas and oil lobby. Kyrsten Sinema is one of the highest people contributing, getting contributions from the pharmaceutical industry, and she's trying to derail the drug price negotiations. So I think there are real questions of whether, you know, there's cohesion even within the Democrats on whether they want to see this expansive agenda passed or if they just want to, you know, twiddle their thumbs and go home.
Yeah, I'm not optimistic about where we are right now. And I think your point is very well taken, Miles. And Monroe has actually agreed to said the same thing down through shows, is that the chief objective of Mitch McConnell has always been, when it comes to Democratic presidents, to sabotage their administrations. This is council wars played on a national scale. In council wars, it was Eddie Bredowiak, Ed Burke, and the white alderman trying to sabotage Harold Washington. In the hopes that you would the voters would turn against him, because the chaos was, and it worked in Chicago. Council wars worked in Chicago. We still, to some degree, are feeling the effects. We even Rahm and Daley and Lori Lightfoot to some degree. So I think that's what's happening, Miles. And I don't understand. I love both of your thoughts on this. It's a conversation I have with political scientist David Ferris all the time about what is the strategy of a Manchin and a Sinema in the resisting efforts by Joe Biden to bring them into the fold. I kind of understand, politically speaking, Manchin. Follow me in this one, Miles. I saw in the newspaper there was an article. West Virginia is so conservative, they've got the lowest vaccination rate in the country. I don't know if you saw that. And that just shows you the impact of MAGA, in my humble opinion, as a political force in West Virginia. Arizona, on the other hand, where Senator Sinema comes from, they're an emerging. They could probably go, they're purple right now. They could be going blue in the next election cycles. I do not understand her strategy at all, Miles. Please help me out. Is it just strictly, in your humble opinion, her ties and connections to these industries? What's going on with Arizona in your mind as to why Cinemax, what she does?
Well, thankfully, Arizona did vote go blue on the presidential level in 2020, which is why there's this insane recount going on in Maricopa County. They're still, you know, I don't know, wasting taxpayers' dollars on it. But yeah, that's a good question. I think that, you know, as I'm sure your listeners are aware, she's got a very unique background in history. Kyrsten Sinema, the senator from Arizona, she was a former Green Party activist, actually, you know, a hard core lefty, and now she's one of the most right-wing Democrats in Congress, and she seems to, you know, enjoy having that role, because people then need to, you know, come to her and get her blessing to do things. You remember she voted against the $15 minimum wage increase, for example, which seems absurd for somebody who once was registered Green Party member. She also went on a besides getting all this money from the pharmaceutical industry, she took a paid, I don't know if you saw this, she took a paid internship at a winery in California over the summer, this past summer, while she was a sitting member of Congress making, you know, six figures. She also went and did a paid internship at a winery. That doesn't sound to me like something somebody who is invested in a long-term career in politics would do. So I think Joe Manchin is a much more traditionally political animal and is fighting for some survival. And so that probably is why he wants to show some independence. And you're right. I think he's the only Democrat right now that could probably win statewide in West Virginia. Kyrsten Sinema, I think it's much harder to read the tea leaves in terms of what her ultimate game plan and end goal is right now. But what we do know is that she hasn't proposed any alternative to the reconciliation. She's just said she's opposed to it. So all we can do is kind of read into it. But Monroe might have other thoughts on that.
I think it's the money. I think the pharma money and the energy money has them locked up. And we'll see if they break on it or not. You know, the thing I wonder is, why don't the Democrats primary these people? Well, you can't do it in Kentucky, because Joe, if it's not Joe, it's going to be a Trump person, not even a regular traditional Republican. It's going to be some really wild Republican that wins. But in Arizona, Virginia, because it is, they should primary her.
Yeah,
well, she's not up for re-election for a few more years.
All right. Now, speaking of money in politics, perfect transition to Rahm Emanuel, former mayor of the city of Chicago, wants to be ambassador to Japan. I talked about this briefly at the top. Miles, get your thoughts on this. On Monday, his financial disclosure statements were released. Kenneth Vogel gave him a shout out from the New York Times, first person I saw who tweeted it out. And in the years since he left office, Rahm has made over $13 million as an investment banker, as an ABC talking head, putting deals together. There's really no specificity as to what deals he put together, if he did anything other than lend his name to the company. It's just the raw numbers. So you talk about money and politics. Monroe raised the topic, Miles. It's right there on display. The man was mayor of the city of Chicago, leaves office and turns that into $12 million worth of cash. It's an investment banker.
Well, and, you know, Ben, okay, now he could have, we don't know, it, but he could have done this off of stocks, you know, as an investment banker. I mean, I don't know. It's probably a blend of the two things. But my stock portfolio is up 40% in the past year. I mean, that's what the stock market has done.
Well, no, this is the money he made. It's not. This is not his personal stock. This is money that is listed as income from I forget the name of the guy. I don't have it in front of me right here. The investment firm that he's employed by. So he cut a deal with them after he left. This is not his individual stock portfolio.
Oh,
this is, yeah, that was nice try, Monroe.
I don't know, you know, but yeah, I mean, Richie's doing okay. You're working for the same bank that gave us the meters.
So. Oh, yeah, Richie. Yeah, our mayors, man. Anyway, Miles, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it was CenterView, which is which is this massive investment banking firm, and yeah, they alone paid him over $12 million of that $13 million. So that was the, and you know, this Rahm has done this before, right? In the late '90s, when he left the Clinton White House, he immediately jumped to a different investment firm and made $16 million in a couple years. So this is kind of Rahm's, you know, deal as he goes and serves some time in public office, supposedly, you know, representing the public good, meanwhile making deals with the corporate entities and the business class and so forth, and then jumps over into the private sector and makes massive amounts of money. So Monroe's right. He does have stocks which are listed, and we don't know how much he's making off of them and a number of other firms, but that's just what he's, the $12 million is what he's been paid. The other question is, you know, he's making all this money from these speeches, from going out and being appearing tons of times with Chris Christie. They have this little, I don't know, buddy comedy deal they do with each other from having that ABC show. But he's just hanging out with the Trump world. He did a speech with Reince Priebus, who was, as we know, Trump's chief of staff. John Kelly, who another Trump chief of staff, he did an event with. So he's buddy-buddy with all these Trump figures. I know giving a speech with somebody doesn't make you best friends, but he did like a half a dozen speeches with Chris Christie, getting paid over $10,000 each time. This is the sign, and it's just funny because so many people think of Rahm as this Democratic bear, you know, that he's like fighting for the democratic values, taking on all the Trump world and the Republican Party. But his whole approach has been to cozy up, or at least try to, you know, find some common ground. And I think that's what you'd see if you were able to read some of these speeches. Of course, we're not, because they were all given at private events. But yeah, I think that it is just another classic case of when business interests and politics align, and it's never for the good of the people.
By the way, and another person who gave a speech was Karl Rove. That one really, Karl Rove was sort of faded as a character in the minds of Democrats. But if you go back about 10 years ago, he was utterly despised by pretty much every Democrat I knew for the role he played in the Bush White House, Baby Bush White House, and the role he played reelecting Baby Bush. And now Rahm's pop. If you want to know what Rahm and Christie say, just listen to the George Stephanopoulos show some Sunday, Miles, and you'll get an earful of this effort to find partisanship by advocating a mixture of tax cuts on the wealthy and continuing where we are with a fierce opposition to any kind of Medicare for all and denouncing the teachers unions and talking about the need for more charter schools, that kind of thing. If you want to know where they're coming from, and I'm sure that's, and then the little war stories they probably throw in at their speeches.
Follow the money. That's the point. Follow the money.
Well, yeah, follow the money. And
the whole reason we know about this is because he's probably going to be the next ambassador to Japan. And there has been a spirited opposition campaign against Rahm Emanuel's nomination, but it's being led by the House progressives, people like Rashida Tlaib and Jamal Bowman, more left-wing members of Congress. But the House doesn't get to confirm, the Senate does. And in the Senate, you see people like Lindsey Graham cheering Rahm Emanuel on. And so he's clearly going to, vote to support the nomination, Lindsey Graham, and he'll probably try to whip some votes on the Republican side for that too. So even if there are some Democratic defections over that nomination, I think you'll see the Republicans make up for that. And I think that's another testament to kind of where Rahm Emanuel lies in today's ideological, spectrum.
Well, we have Manchin in charge of the energy thrust for Biden, and he made $500,000 last year off of dinosaur oil. Fossil fuels. So, I mean, it's just a very weird world we're in right now.
If I could just really quick on the question of that, I do think that it is a fair, we should point out whenever there's, clear conflicts, and there's no doubt that $500,000 in a year from an industry that you're supposedly, legislating around and hopefully regulating, that's a conflict. That said, one way around it I would offer is that, it makes sense because that's such a powerful industry in his state, right? The oil and gas is, so it makes sense that they would donate a lot of money to him. If you want to look at it from that perspective, the way around some of this conflict, then I would offer is what they could do is just throw a whole bunch of money for West Virginia into this reconciliation bill to, get those workers trained first in clean energy jobs or do some transition, and find some way to appease some of these interests, even if it seems like, a giveaway or something. If it's in order to pass this massive legislative effort that would radically improve the lives of people all over the country, that is probably a deal worth making. So I hope that there's some of that, wheeling and dealing going on at the White House today to figure this whole thing out.
We saw that in Illinois last week. We've talked about it on the show with the energy bill passed and signed by Pritzker, where money went to Commonwealth Edison to keep its nuclear power plants open. So that workers wouldn't lose their jobs and Commonwealth Edison wouldn't have to close those facilities. And I just had to shake my head and smile because that's exactly what you were getting at there, Miles. It's just greasing the wheels to get something passed. And I don't know if you can grease the wheels in Washington these days in the face of Mitch McConnell sabotaging government, going back to the last conversation. And I don't know if what Rahm does is in any way remotely linked to passing legislation that it would help people. I think what Rahm does is cut deals and help Rahm and his clients. And it's not about helping people at all. That's what's so dispiriting about it. And I'll get back to something that, Miles, that we talk about a lot on this show. And it's one of my favorite topics. It's the issue of shaming voters. And I always say, you know, when you and Mikey give me, and Sarah Lazar, throw her in the list, give me grief for shaming voters. And I got to give the voters a pass. And I'm talking MAGA voters out there. I'm going to give you guys MAGA a shout out here. Because MAGA, I'm thinking about this a lot since I've been watching that Lewinsky-Clinton series on TV. But Rahm, what he does when he leaves government after professing to care so much about the poor people of Chicago and not really doing anything for the poor people of Chicago and goes right out and becomes an investment banker, and Lord knows what he did to earn $12 million, Miles, that just feeds the cynicism that is so alive in this country and that gets so many MAGA people to say, what difference does it make, Democrat or Republican? They're all just feeding at the trough. They're all just looking out for each other. They don't care about me. And I, at some level, Miles and Monroe, I don't know how to answer that. When you see examples like Rahm, $13 million in 2 years. And I don't know what he does as an investment banker that would help anybody in the city of Chicago. You know what I'm saying? It's not like he's putting together an industry that's going to bring jobs to the west side or the south side or create new way, new forms of energy, or, you know, he's not putting his mind on policing tactics or techniques, anything that would help anybody in the city of Chicago. So, Miles, confront this issue. Democrats just make their party look so bad when they leave office. They make their party look so hypocritical when they leave office and cut deals like this. So I kind of have to say that you and Micah and Sarah do have a very good point when it comes to shaming voters. When you see things like Miles, we see things like Rahm and what he does. Your thoughts, Miles?
Yeah, there's plenty of reason to be cynical about politics. I think even besides seeing individual politicians profit off of their positions in government, it's the lack of action, you know, and follow through on campaign promises that breeds the most cynicism, you know, because everybody just sounds like a liar when nothing gets done in Washington and or nothing gets done at a state house or, you know, city hall. And I think that that is, you know, we're in Chicago. We just saw, you know, Lori Lightfoot, current mayor, introduced a budget. She campaigned on a promise I very much remember of reopening the mental health clinics in the city that Rahm Emanuel, when he was mayor, shuttered half of the city mental health clinics. When she was running as a candidate, Lori Lightfoot said she would reopen them. And the new budget, once again, does not, just like the last budget, does not do anything to reopen the mental health clinics. It does make further investments in mental health, which is good, but we got this $1.9 billion in relief funding. You'd think that could go into following through on a campaign promise, but yet again, I think that that's the kind of thing that really breeds cynicism. Now, I'm not saying that's going to lose Lori Lightfoot the support she has necessarily, but when you know, look at that on a broader scale, I gotta say, I've done plenty of door knocking and campaigning and organizing for candidates, for issues, for causes, for organizations. And what I hear, you know, is the same thing anybody hears. They're all liars. They're all crooks. You know, why would I back this person? They never do anything. So I think the way that you push back against that cynicism is by delivering on the stuff you said you were going to do. And that's why I think this push for actually implementing the Biden agenda, the Build Back Better agenda, is so important. Because if they don't do that, I don't think, you know, not only do Democrats, will that be doom for Democrats in 2022? That could be down the road. You know, if everybody just sees, oh, we had Trump and we needed to get over for them. So we got the Democrats, and then nothing really changed. Or, you know, even the child tax credit, which is great, is set to expire at the end of this year if they don't extend it. How are we going to expect that voters are going to give Democrats another chance unless they actually follow through on some of this stuff? Having a Rahm Emanuel definitely does not help. But I will say, in another city, Rahm Emanuel would probably be running in a, you know, as a Republican rather than a Democrat. It's just because we have a one party city that he was able to kind of position himself. But if you look at the agenda that he was running on compared to other people's agendas, it was pretty conservative in terms of today's Democratic Party.
Well, he was installed. He didn't really. I mean, that was so rigged. You know, it's Daley just retires at the right moment, and there he is to pick up the mantle. That was a dance or something. I don't know what you call that, but that was not democracy at play right then.
No, it was an installation. You got that right. Obama couldn't take another minute of him. And in the White House, or at least Michelle Obama couldn't take another minute of him, kicked him out. And they, oh God, I just feel about it. I just shake my head. They staged that little farewell, a ceremony at the White House where Barack Obama was the master of delivering those remarks like he really means them. Oh, Rahm, we're really going to miss you. And they usher him. I don't know, Miles, if you remember this. I remember it. They usher him. They send him home in quotes to Chicago, a city he's barely lived in, knows nothing about, and immediately tells Karen Lewis, shut up and let me fire a bunch of teachers. That's it is. It's a sad and cynical display. And I think the consequence locally, and I'd love to get Monroe's thoughts and Miles' thoughts on this, is not so much, obviously, people in Chicago voting Republican, it's people in Chicago not voting. And this helps Lori Lightfoot, and it helps Rahm. I think the turnout is like 35%.
Yeah.
35%. You talk to anybody in Chicago, not anybody, diehards that listen to my show, but the vast number of people in Chicago, Monroe, you know this. They have no belief whatsoever in their city government. They roll their eyes at it. Like Miles said, they think they're a bunch of crooks and blowhards. And 35%. I remember, I'd say this all the time, Pat Hill, may she rest in peace. I was teasing her. I go, well, black people elected Rahm Emanuel. And she goes, no, they didn't, because black people didn't vote. That was her explanation, because the majority of black people voted for Rahm in 2011. But she was saying when actually the majority of black people didn't vote at all. So Monroe, yeah. Really, that's the devastating consequences, is that people just give up and quit, and they just don't think there's anything they get out of participating in politics. And it makes it that much harder for programs to pass that would benefit them.
Right. And you know, and the powers that be in Chicago, they have things just locked up. They really do. This is why the voters don't vote. Phil Klein told me, and I didn't know how much of it was true or not, but he facilitated Obama's candidacy. He went to Donovan, he says, and told him this is the guy. Then he sat down with Obama and asked him, says, do you want to be president? You know, very assertively. And Obama was sort of weak and milquetoasty about it. And he pressed him and he said, I said, do you got to want to be president? So, and it went that way.
Yeah, not Phil Klein. I know who you're talking about, though. His last name wasn't Klein.
He died of cancer.
Yes, he did. Back. He was a real operator.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
He was always telling stories.
I'm thinking Klein then.
I don't know. He'd be a guy I would call. He was one of these guys. This is an operator, Miles, that would talk to liberals. Like every now and then they'll have like the Peter Cunningham comes on the show, a friend of this show, was one of those. So the machine has guys like that.
Right.
Their job is to talk to the Miles of the world.
Right.
I don't know if they ever make their way to you, Miles, but occasionally they'll make their way to me. They talk to, like, you know, they can like understand your lingo and then they try to appease you. And Phil was that way, Monroe. That guy you're talking.
Yeah, Phil was that guy. You know, he's a good friend of Joe English's too.
Yeah.
But I can't. Okay.
From Austin.
Yeah.
So Miles, that's why I think it's an important story to illuminate what Rahm Emanuel is up to in the hopes that the city will disassociate itself from him and or from that type of politics. But I don't see that happening in Chicago or in the Democratic Party, particularly. And that's why it's symbolically so wretched that Joe Biden would nominate him to be ambassador to Japan. Your thoughts, Miles?
Yeah, they haven't. They're even boasting, I think, the administration, that there has not been the type of cohesive opposition or resistance to Rahm Emanuel's nomination as there have been to other nominees in the past, including Neera Tanden, you know, who was the only high level post that Joe Biden had to pull back the nomination for. And that was over the resistance of Joe Manchin, largely, even though, you know, Joe Manchin is the same person who approved all these, you know, voted for Trump nominees that said all kinds of horrible things about Democrats. But apparently Neera Tanden doing it was too much. I mean, there's plenty of issues, I think, with Neera Tanden, you know, and her opposition to the left wing of the Democratic Party in many instances. But the you know, mean tweets she wrote was an absurd reason to sink a nomination. Now, somebody who covered up a video of a police murder and somebody who, you know, oversaw massive disinvestment in communities of color in their city, like Rahm Emanuel, you'd think there's maybe more of a reason to oppose that nomination. I think that's why you are hearing vocal opposition from, there's some groups like Roots Action, Norman Solomon is involved in that group. I know he's been on the show. And of course, you know, as I mentioned, a number of like members of the squad and the left wing in the House are speaking out against it. And I think that this example of this story of him profiting off of his time in office helps to back up their position. But you're right. I don't think that that's been enough to convince the Biden administration. I do think, though, that Rahm Emanuel running on the agenda he did in 2015, maybe 2011, would have a harder time. I don't know. I mean, I think you guys are both right that he was installed, you know, that was not a, you know, completely, that was, you know, Obama helped to get him the mayorship in 2011. But in 2015, he did have to run on an agenda. And I don't think that would have been as embraced in today's Democratic Party as it was then, because things have changed. I think the COVID pandemic has just changed how people view the role of government and their expectations of it. And certainly it's shifted the mainstream of the Democratic Party to the left. How that plays out on the local level is always questionable, but I do think that there has been some change there. And that's at least one positive direction, even if we wind up with an ambassador, Rahm.
Yeah, and we will wind up with an ambassador. I must concede that. I think you're absolutely correct, Miles. The only I'll go on. I said this the last time we were in the show. Bernie will vote against him. I'm not sure about Elizabeth Warren, and there are enough Republicans. What a joke! I had hoped that there'd be some aggressive MAGAites who would ask him tough questions in the nomination process. Maybe one or two of them will step up. I doubt it, though. It looks like they're lining up for Rahm. And I just laugh because Neera Tanden, they bounced her because she wrote nasty tweets about Ted Cruz. I'd have to laugh. Man, Democrats, the way that Democrats play the political game and the way Republicans play the political game, Miles and Monroe, I do not understand why Democrats think they can prevail. Democrats, they love to go against their base. They love to go against their base, man. They love to go against their lefty base and their black base. And they think that's how you win over middle America. And that's how you win elections. And Republicans would never in a million years, if you had a candidate for any position being put out there by a Democrat or Republican that MAGA despised as much as the left base despises Rahm, no way.
No, Mitt Romney wouldn't vote for him. Susan Collins wouldn't vote for him. It's the difference miles between Democrats and Republicans. Democrats like to beat up their base every now and then to show that they're independent and beat up Miles a little bit, run him around a little bit, and mess with Monroe. That's how you show them you're independent.
Well, that was especially true during the Obama years, and I think Rahm Emanuel was a big part of that. I mean, he called the progressives effing retarded, which is a extremely, you know, vulgar phrase to use. But he also said, you know, screw the UAW when, you know, there was the fight over the auto bailouts and the union was asking for, you know, support for auto workers. Rahm Emanuel took that kind of tone. You'd think that organized labor, you know, the traditional base of the Democratic Party, would be supported in the White House by the chief of staff. But no, he decided to pick a fight and call, and Robert Gibbs was calling everybody under the left, the professional left, and speaking out against it. I think that that was a real time when there was clear resistance to progressives as somehow against the base of the party. But I think that hopefully is starting to change.
Well, you know, the reason Rahm got $13 million in 2 years is because he's a corporationalist. He was one of their crowd. So, of course, I mean, that was his position. That's how he operates. That's his perspective. And that's how he ran the city. In fact, the reason we have all these skyscrapers along the Chicago River is because he cut through all the red tape and made it possible for it to happen real quickly instead of with all the haggling and things that would have gone with it normally. He just said, okay, corporations in Chicago, that'll be good. I was on the board of the Arts Alliance Illinois, and they were trying to get it where there would be art events throughout the city in various neighborhoods, thinking that would liven the city and make it better. Rahm wanted one big major event that had national, made Chicago an international destiny for people who wanted arts, but just one big one. He wasn't interested in the community. I mean, that's how he was, how he is.
That's a good example. Monroe, he wasn't interested in community. I don't know if he's responsible for any of the big skyscrapers any more than anybody else, but he is the walkway. That's his great claim to fame, which you're talking about, the walkway along the Chicago River.
Yeah, but I mean, you look at all those buildings. I mean, all that happened in the, not all of it, much of it happened in the short period of time he was a mayor.
Well, there was a lot of downtown development under Mayor Richard M. Daley as well. That's just been the planning strategy going back to Richard J. Daley. Let's build in the loop. You know it as well as I do, Monroe, because you've been around as long as I have. That is just the prevailing planning strategy in the city of Chicago. The strongest we can make the downtown, the better off we are. And I have no idea if Mayor Lori Lightfoot subscribes to that notion, because the pandemic has sort of stifled development. Yeah. We'll see where she goes.
Well, she is a corporate lawyer.
Yes, you're right. You're right, Monroe. All right, now I got to ask Monroe this question. They get Miles to weigh in. We haven't got to this one yet, and I feel compelled. I've been bashing Democrats. Let me turn around and deal with MAGA. Man, what a bunch of nonsense. Front page of the New York Times today. I don't know. I know Monroe saw it, Miles. I don't know if you saw it. It turns out that when MAGA and Trump and Sidney Powell and all the rest of those knuckleheads were making up their talk of voter theft and Dominion and how Joe Biden didn't really win, they knew it was BS. And they were putting it out there anyway. And ultimately, it didn't work in that Joe Biden was sworn in as president. But you still got 40% or so of MAGA that believes it's true, even though. I'm sorry. I know I'm not supposed to shame voters. I just got finished. Even though Giuliani and Powell and the rest of them knew it wasn't true, MAGA still believes it. Monroe, help me out with this.
They believe it because they want to believe it. It fits into where they want things to be. The main thing that they are concerned about is all these non-white people rising and taking over their country. That's what bringing back America means, is that we go back to Leave It to Beaver time. What was the city with the sheriff and the...
Mayberry.
Yeah, Mayberry. In fact, I don't know if you saw, you watch CBS Sunday Morning, but they did a piece on a town that has appropriated the whole Mayberry set, basically. And they have the cars and the everything, and they're Mecca for MAGA people now.
That's a trip, man.
Yeah. And so,
by the way, Monroe, it's very unlikely that I'll ever see CBS Sunday Morning, since I'm not usually awake until CBS Sunday Afternoon.
Yeah.
I'm known as a late riser.
You know, they have these things now, Ben, they're called video recorders. you can actually tape something in the morning and look at it when you get up in the early afternoon.
I roll out of bed just in time to see the Bears enter the second quarter of a 12 o'clock game. Miles, your thought on MAGA and the cheating, the claims of cheating, et cetera, and so forth.
Well, the animating principle of the modern conservative movement is grievance. And I think Monroe's right to portray it as white grievance. I mean, that is what they have chosen as their, you know, a cause celeb is taking our country back, basically, and taking back what was taken from them. And I think that that was always, you know, what was underneath Make America Great Again. It was this idea that, you know, the white America, the Mayberry America that Monroe's talking about from the 1950s has been upended by all these dangerous things, like having a reckoning over racism in America or trying to, you know, deal with a legacy of oppression and exploitation of, well, people from all backgrounds, but particularly communities of color. And this time they decided, okay, well, we can get people mad about something else being stolen, the election, you know, and we're going to say, for one thing, then Trump doesn't have to admit he lost, which, if you read The Art of the Deal, that has always been his approach to anything, is just don't admit any fault, don't admit you ever lost, just project strength. So he was, you know, clearly always going to do this. So it helps him and his ego. And then it also helps the base to have a way to deal with the fact that they lost, you know, by saying we didn't lose, you know, and actually the election was stolen. And so we're going to fight to get it back. That's why they stormed the Capitol. And that's why the base still believes in Dominion, even though you're right. Of course, it was a cynical ploy made by, you know, right wing elites that don't care. You know, they're getting it paid either way. Giuliani and Sidney Powell. But they're able to stoke this base because they've gotten them so riled up over all kinds of issues. You know, I think that it's interesting to see how, like, critical race theory has gone out of the public discussion, but it served its purpose to get people really angry. And now that anger is turning into over vaccine mandates and masks and things like that. It's just, if you gin people up and get this constant outrage machine running, you can kind of swap in any issue, but the election being stolen, I think, is really helps to keep that principle of grievance and white grievance going.
Yeah, well, so they just keep it going. You look at Kaepernick, for example, and his taking the knee, and how that became such a big issue when there was nothing to it, really, except he was protesting a black man being killed by a white cop.
Yeah, man. Oh, God, Monroe, Colin Kaepernick. Everything you guys just said is they tie to, like Miles said, swap in any issue. It doesn't matter if it's real or not. Just swap it in. Colin Kaepernick, of course, was vilified as unpatriotic
against the military, et cetera, and so forth. That was so 2016, because they tried to cancel his culture. And now, supposedly, they're outraged at liberals who cancel their culture, lefties who cancel their culture and make them pay for their political beliefs. And I can't think of one MAGA person who stood up for Colin Kaepernick's right to peacefully protest. Can't think of one. So they clearly have no principle that they're following. It's just a tactic. It's just swapping in one. I'm going to steal that line, Miles, and maybe give you credit. I don't know. Swap in one issue. That's great. That is really insightful. Just swap it in, drop it in. Critical race theory. You're right. That's not playing on the radio right now for MAGA. It'll come back. Miles, it will come back because that one works well for them. But right now, they're probably talking border stuff.
They're talking border and mask. I mean, they're snatching masks off of people's faces and things. I mean, it's just, it's ridiculous the way they are. And what's really makes this interesting is while they don't want the vaccination mandated because it's their body and their choice, but on the other hand, when it comes to abortions, then it's okay for the state to tell a woman what she should do with her body.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And no consistency whatsoever. All right, Miles, before we end it for the day, give some shout outs to In These Times, great publication. A lot of outstanding writers, a lot of outstanding young writers, I always say. Anything you in particular want to alert people to?
Of course. Yes, please check out inthesetimes.com. And you can sign up for our weekly newsletter. It comes every Saturday and then has all the headlines. We've got a great story up by Hamilton Nolan right now, my great coworker, on this reconciliation fight. In terms of shout outs, I got to give a shout out to somebody you brought up earlier, Peter Cunningham, because I actually ran into him on the Montrose Beach the other day, and he remembered me from the show and other such things. So he has not tried to, influence me in any way besides, being talking to me about some rock and roll stuff. So shout out to Peter Cunningham. And I got to give a shout out to a new addition to the fam, which is since the last time I was on the show, I actually became an uncle. My brother, August, and his wife, Rachel, had a beautiful baby named Owen, baby boy. So he's doing well. So yeah, big shout out to Owen.
All right. Owen, welcome to the dance, Owen. Welcome to the dance. All right. And so, gentlemen, the next time I talk to you, I will be in Los Angeles, and I'm going to do the show remotely for a couple of weeks while I'm in Los Angeles. Today was a test run here on the laptop, but it's so far it seems to have worked. Thanks to Dennis. He put up with me at the outset. Oh, geez, folks, if you could have seen that. Anyway, so I'll be having to get up early, Monroe, relatively early, because L.A., of course, is 2 hours behind. So what I think we're going to do is start the show at noon. I mean, I start the show at 2, so I don't have to get up that early in L.A., so we may start the show when I'm in L.A. At noon. I'll be out there for a couple weeks.
Well, it's 12:34 in L.A. Yes.
So could you imagine if I had to start the show at 11 in the morning? I mean, having gone to bed at about 5, which is kind of my hours these days. By the way, one last thing. I know Monroe watched the first 2 episodes. Miles, you haven't watched it. I urge everybody to watch Impeachment. Everything we've talked about in this show is dramatized in Impeachment. It's both the duplicity of Democrats like Bill Clinton and his little sidekick, Rahm Emanuel, but just the utter hypocrisy and relentlessness of the right, pre-MAGA, to take down the Clintons any way they can, and the way they manipulated people. And it's just getting, it's just a fascinating.
The vast right-wing conspiracy.
Yeah, that's right. Hillary Clinton said it, and Hillary, you were right.
You are absolutely right. All these characters, Miles, I don't know if you've seen it. Ann Coulter is a player in it. George Conway is a player in it. Anti-abortionist, Ken Starr, they're all Brett Kavanaugh. You know, it like, wow, it's deep.
Right. So, but speaking of TV series, did you see any of the Muhammad Ali?
I have not. I've not watched any of that yet. And
Tim Burns is very good.
Yeah, I'm obsessed with Ali. I will watch it. We're probably going to do a whole bunch of shows on that. I'm a huge. Are you an Ali fan, Miles?
Yeah, of course. I love that. The movie you actually recommended me, the One Night in Miami.
Cool. One Night in Miami. It's a great flick. Shout out to Sergio Mims. He's the one who recommended that to me. All right. Monroe Anderson, Miles Konflassen, thank you very much. And also want to thank the man, the myth, the legend, the pride and joy of all of Illinois, without whom this show would be possible. And it's especially true today. And as Miles Monroe will tell you, back home in Alton, they call him Dr. D. Give yourself a raise. Take it out of petty cash. See you tomorrow, everybody.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.